Bam.
Just a summary about attraction, okay? That's the upstream approach. Now, if we just deal with conflict resolution and marriage issues and how a marriage can stay fun over time, I think we're just dealing downstream. And you're never going to deal with the real root of the problem. We've got to go upstream. So who you are as a single is beginning to define who you will be as a spouse. So be mindful of that. So the things you watch, the things you look at, the practices you have, the way you attract, all of that is preparing you now for marriage. Now, there's no secret that marriages in our culture are completely jacked, falling apart half of the time, literally, in and out of the church, almost a 50% divorce rate. So the only way that we change that is if we get upstream, and it starts with how you attract. Attraction is based off of character. It's who someone is on the inside. It's their godliness. It's not based on looks. Now, it doesn't mean that you shouldn't be attracted to the person who you spend time with. It just means that shouldn't be the first carrot that you pursue. You should pursue something deeper. Because if it's only on the outside, remember there's three problems with looks-based attraction. Looks don't last. Looks can be deceiving. Looks are always canceled out by character. Which means you're looking for the right type of person. And more importantly, you're trying to become the right type of person. So if you find yourself in sort of relational neutral, trying to figure out how to gain traction and maybe see if you can meet somebody, keep focusing on who you are. The God who provides will provide for you at the proper time. In the meantime, become the right type of person. Then you move into dating. The ultimate goal of dating is have fun, relax, take the pressure off. Just because you date doesn't mean you need to go buy a ring. Just because you date doesn't mean you need to go buy a bride magazine. Just go to dinner and calm down. Have fun. Go dancing. Laugh. Relax. It's okay. The church is notorious for putting so much pressure on a date that nobody ever dates. The problem is the non-believing dudes, boy, he's going to ask her out. But Christian guys get scared. Man up. Ask her out and quit being weird about it. Just go have fun. Yeah, if she doesn't like you, she'll tell you. That's fine. Pull your pride off the floor and relax and don't make a big deal out of it. Now, that being said, two things about dating. Date in groups and date in public. You don't need privacy. You don't need one-on-one time. You don't need it. So if you'll do that, then and you date where it's non-emotional, non-spiritual, non-physical, and non-escalating, then who cares if you date this girl and then date that girl and then date that girl? You're going to have a reputation, that's for sure. But it's not going to be for being shady. It's going to be for taking care of ladies and not being a guy who's a dishonoring guy, if that's the way you date. Now, if you're reaching for her pants, you've got bigger problems, and ladies, kick him to the curb and give me his name. And we'll follow up with him, because that's not what a man of God is. So that's how you date. At some point, a date becomes plural. Date singular, great. Date twice, okay. Date three times, man, at some point the game's going to change. Now, when do you have to move from courtship to dating? You have to move from courtship, or excuse me, from dating to courtship. When do you move from dating to courtship? When you have a different view of the relationship than she does. And if she has a different view of the relationship, fellas, it's not her fault, it's your fault. She should not have to stalk your Facebook to see if you're Facebook official. She honestly should listen to you. And you should tell her exactly where you are. So if you go three dates with a girl, she's going to start wondering, hey, I don't see him hanging out one-on-one with any other ladies. So where are we at here? As soon as she asks where we're at here, as a guy, my opinion, you've already whiffed. So get it in gear, initiate with that girl. Tell her what you're thinking. If you're not sure what you're thinking, then please quit playing the like Twilight, I don't know what to do, I don't know. Break up with a girl, get your life on track, get your act together, then go date a girl. When you're ready to know what you want, who you are, what you're looking for, do you understand what I'm saying with that? Because that happens all the time where a guy will date her, yeah, I don't know, man, I don't know if I like her or not. You've gone out with her like 12 times. Like you've seen every Lord of the Rings movie ever made together, one-on-one, which means you've been dating forever, but you don't know what you want. Then ladies, let him go. Let him go. Because that's a pattern. He's not going to go find a job when he gets married. He's not going to know what to do to provide for you when you're together. Make sure you find a guy who knows what he wants and is moving towards it. Question in the back.
Yeah, you're talking about dating in groups. So is that like initial dates then? Because you are mentioning like one-on-one dates.
I think as soon as it moves towards one-on-one, you've got to change the game. So initial dates are, hey, get three or four of your homies and say, hey, look, let's all go to the movies. Let's grab some friends of ours. Let's go. Let's go play Ultimate. Hey, let's go ski. Let's go whatever. But you're just spending time with people. You're finding a good excuse to be around good people and laugh and kind of see where's the chemistry. You know, I mentioned, you know, when my wife and I started hanging out, it was in a coffee shop. Shay and Mike were there. She had her little homegirls. And all of a sudden, there's like chemistry. I'm like, this is weird. I've known Jen for years, and there's never been anything. Thank you, by the way, for contributing to our late fee. Appreciate that. You're a good man. Which, by the way, I need you to take care of that because we're going to Israel next week. So I'm not kidding. So take care of that. That'd be great. So you understand what I'm saying? Then there's chemistry. Then you're moving. Once you're starting to go one-on-one, you got to change the game a little bit. Okay, now you can do a date with it. You can go to a movie together, go to dinner together. That's fine. So it doesn't always have to be groups. My point is you're never going to struggle in a group. You're never going to struggle in public. So the story of moral failure always happens alone and in private. Okay? Once you move to courtship, it's fun still. I almost just put fine-tuning, but then it just gets really serious. Like tractor pull serious. Like it's getting heavier over time. Still have fun, but that's where you're doing some fine-tuning. And I want to suggest to you it's intentional, it's male-initiated, and it's declarative. You know what I mean by that, fellas? Did you hear me here a year ago when we talked about courtship? You need to declare your intentions. You need to share where you're at, and you need to give her the opportunity to just nod her way through the process. I'm good, I'm good, I'm good, I'm good. And if she ever says I'm not good, then back off. If not, bounce, depending on what she tells you. If she says you're going too fast, back off. If she says thank you, but no thank you, I want to date your friend or whatever, then bounce. Okay, don't be a stalker. But I want to suggest to you it's male initiated. The reason is, again, it's pattern setting. Because in a marriage, it's male headship. And we talked a little bit about headship and what that means and what it doesn't mean. We talked about submission, what it means, what it doesn't mean. It's a mutual submission as unto the Lord, but we are equal, but we're not the same. And I think you need to hear that. And I recognize, look, I get it, okay? There's a fear for a lot of women when you talk about submission. But I want to suggest to you that if I only show you one side of the coin without the other, there's all kinds of fear because of the unknown. I want to show you both sides of the coin to say this is male headship, and therefore this is what submission looks like as you mutually submit to the Lord. It changes the game. Do you understand that? Like, does that make sense? So that's what the courtship process is. It's declarative, then it moves to marriage, male headship, mutual submission, under the Lord, equal, not same, then comes intimacy. Intimacy is about oneness. It's not about sex. And we'll watch that here in just a moment. Literally, oneness. Marital intimacy is not a physical thing, per se. It's an overflow of emotion. God rigged it that man would leave his mother and father, be joined to his wife, two would become one flesh. That flesh union would bring them together in privacy, in exclusivity, and in that sense of bond that only is reserved for a husband and a wife, which is why adultery is so damaging. Because it's a violation of the very vault of sanctity that is oneness in a marriage. Which is why, pause that for a moment, premarital intimacy is so incredibly dangerous. Because it's a violation of that vault that God has prepared in you for your spouse one day. And if you get used to opening yourself up and giving yourself away, this does not change your fidelity. You understand what I'm saying? Again, it's pattern setting. So as a single, God is preparing you to be able to handle lust, handle desire, handle looking at other people that are exceedingly attractive to you, teaching you to bounce your eyes, to take thoughts captive to the obedience of Christ, to flee from youthful lust, all of which you will need when you're married. So again, if you're in a dating context and you're with someone who cannot keep their hands off of you, they are not ready. Because there's going to be a woman on a business trip somewhere, and he's going to have a cocktail, and all of a sudden, he's going to go back to his old pattern. You've got to control your flesh. The other argument I made with that is we end up divorced multiple times before we ever get married because we've given ourselves away. Okay, so intimacy is about oneness. It's about enjoyment. It's not about procreation. Now, that's a wonderful byproduct of sexual intimacy. But my point with that is when you read through the text and it talks about a husband being satisfied always with the breasts of the wife of his youth, that has nothing to do with making babies. That has everything to do with that enjoyment of oneness. Now, why would I share that with you? Because, again, I don't think we're sharing the why enough. Don't have sex before you're married, and then we quit talking. Because this is what God wants for you. This is God's design. This is the garden of delight that God has created within the proper context of husbands and wives. It's meant to be private, meaning I'll tell you a lot of things about my wife, but our bedroom is none of your business. And it never should be. And I don't tell my buddies about it, and she doesn't tell her girls about it. Why? Because that's ours. That's a private place. Does that make sense? And so you got to be careful. You know, especially married dudes, you start running your mouth about your sex life, you'll be on the couch quick. It's earned. It's not deserved, which means this kind of oneness we're going to see, it's not something that should be expected. I would even say it's a privilege. It's not a right. Like, I talk to guys all the time, and they're like, oh, man, my sex life is lacking. You know, can you talk with my wife? I'm like, no, I need to talk with you. Because if you'll do what you need to do, and she's a healthy woman, meaning not wounded by mistreatment or abuse or having experienced pain, which is, by the way, I think it's 1 out of 4 women will experience some sort of sexual abuse in their lifetime. Now, do the math. That's terrifying. It may even be lower than that. I can't remember off the top of my head. But my point is, fellas, you've got to be very gentle with this woman as you're moving into marriage. If she's a healthy woman, hasn't been scarred in the past, or even if she's worked through that, and you're making the deposits into her life, the intimacy will be a natural overflow of that. It's a privilege, not a right. Conflict now, that's what we're going to get into today. The key to conflict is learning how to respond and not react. Respond and not react, and I'll explain that in a moment. And then you've got to seek resolution. The wedge of unresolved conflict in a marriage, if left unchecked, literally just begins to separate a union. And if you're not willing to resolve conflict and seek resolution, what you're going to find is those little things that really didn't matter, but you really were kind of ticked about it, but you never really talked it through, will become big things like tree roots that break the concrete. Like, it won't do it overnight, but over time, it'll start cracking the very foundation of your marriage if you don't resolve it. And then ultimately, the thing I want to show you here this morning is how to deepen a marriage. And what's funny is when I first started talking about Song of Solomon, I was a newlywed. So, like, the book only mattered to me until chapter 4. You know, let's just get to the intimacy part. Let's spend our time there. But now, I've been married 17 years. I'm enjoying chapter 7 and following in a way that I never had before. And so I want to show you that, because this idea of marriage being a ball and chain, you just kind of endure it, you know, till one day you're sitting at, you know, some diner slurping your soup, neither one of you talking to each other, and that's kind of marriage. I go, no. I went to dinner, I went to dinner a while back, and there was an older couple there, and literally they ate dinner. My wife and I were on a date, looked over, they ate dinner, never said a word to each other. Never said a word. I could not. I'm like, this is getting weird. I could not ever, like, I didn't see them move their lips. I didn't see them acknowledge each other. Didn't say a word. And I thought, no way. Not on my watch. Not my marriage. Y'all can do what you want, but I'm going to love that woman. And I'm going to pursue that woman until I am too old to even remember her name. That's my goal. And I think you can do that, and I'll show you that here in just a moment. So, does that make sense? Overview. Chapter 4, look at verse 7. Remember, we finished, if I remember correctly, we finished at verse 7. She's now naked before her man. He says, you are altogether beautiful, my darling. There is no blemish in you. Is that where we finished? I'm trying to remember. Okay. In that moment, he just speaks life into her, right? Affirms her. Now, let's watch what happens. He invites her in verse 8 to come, and he mentions now the from Lebanon, from the summit of Amana, from the summit of Senir and Hermon, from the dens of lions, from the mountains of leopards. He's calling her out of vulnerable places, dangerous places, calling her to him and to enjoy this sense of mutual delight. Notice verse 9 that he's experiencing. He says, "You have made my heart beat faster. My sister, my bride, you've made my heart beat faster with a single glance of your eyes, with a single strand of your necklace. How beautiful is your love, my sister, my bride. How much better is your love than wine, and the fragrance of your oils than all kinds of spices." When I say that attraction shouldn't be based on looks, that doesn't mean that there shouldn't be chemistry. It means that chemistry or looks shouldn't be the main thing. This guy, when he looks at this woman, literally his pulse races in verse 9 with a single glance of her eyes and just looking at her, even in a snapshot, he's losing his mind. And in verse 10, notice he says, "How much better is your love than wine and the fragrance of your oils than spices?" Do you see the play on words there? Do you remember how the book began in chapter 1? "May he kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is better than wine. Your oils have a pleasing fragrance." He flips the script and now says that to her. And you're going to see that playfulness. This couple has fun together. They're playing back and forth. "You said this, well, I say that. You said that, well, I say this." And they're kind of, it's almost like inside jokes. Have you ever been around a married couple who, like, he says something and all of a sudden she's flushed and you're like, "What? I don't even understand that." Well, there's a code in their marriage, and he dropped it, and she heard it, but it was like, thankfully, nobody else knew what they were talking about, or it would be really awkward. That's what's happening here. And so he invites her now to come because of his delight in her. "Your lips," verse 11, "drip honey. Honey and milk are under your tongue." How does he know honey and milk are under her tongue? What's beginning to occur? I know you don't want to say it either, but it's exactly what you think. So they're beginning to kiss. It's not a French kiss, by the way. It's a Hebrew kiss. It outdates a French kiss by centuries. "And the fragrance of your garments is like the fragrance of Lebanon." In 12 and following, he reflects upon her chastity, her propriety, calls her a garden locked, a rock garden locked up, a spring sealed up. Remember in chapter 1 when she was talking about her body? She said, "My mother's sons were angry with me. They made me caretakers of the vineyard. I haven't been able to take care of my own vineyard." So she's speaking here, or he's speaking here, of her body, that she was locked, that there was no entrance. But in 13 and following, there was this incredible production, this aroma, this satisfaction coming from her body. And in 15, he says, "You are a garden spring, a well of fresh water, and streams flowing in Lebanon. You are refreshing. You are delightful. You are full," in 13 and following, "of orchards of pomegranates with henna and nard," verse 14, "nard and saffron, calamus, cinnamon, frankincense, myrrh, aloe, the finest of spices." This guy's looking at the nakedness of his wife and incredibly delighted in what he sees. Now, I've joked as I've done marriage counseling that I really would love to hear feedback from a woman who would quote verse 16 on her honeymoon night. I'm fairly confident that groom will pass out right there. Twice she came on to him, correct? Dating context. "Let his left hand be under my head, his right hand embrace me." And in a courtship context, "Till the cool of the day when the shadows flee away, turn my beloved, be like a gazelle or a young stag on the mountains of Bether. Refresh me with apples, sustain me with raisin cakes, for I'm lovesick." You remember that. Twice he stepped up. Twice he led in the relationship. What did he say? 2735, "Do not arouse or awaken love until," do not arouse or awaken love until it pleases. Do not arouse or awaken love until it pleases. Now they're on their honeymoon. Proper context of marital love has been built. This isn't a couch fire. This isn't now messing around outside of what God designed. This is husband and this is wife. And look at what she says. "Awake, O north wind, and come, wind of the south, make my garden breathe out fragrance. Let its spices be wafted abroad. May my beloved," and listen to this, "come into his garden, and eat its choice fruits." Anybody want to make a comment on what the heck is happening right here? She's it was like, heck no. She's literally on the honeymoon night, naked before her husband, affirmed in the perfection that he sees in her, and she's going like this. Come on. All this that we've waited for, all this that you've longed for, all this that you've said, don't arouse or awaken love until it pleases. Well, right now, in this moment, the time is right. We've done the hard work. Come on. And so what happens in verses 1 and following is he's going to respond about the after effects, if you will, of that moment. Notice what he says. He says, I have come into my garden, my sister, my bride. I have gathered my myrrh along with my balsam. I have eaten my honeycomb and my honey. I have drunk my wine and my milk. What do you notice about that that verse? What do you notice? Just by way of observation. I'm not going to make this creepy in any way. What do you see? Come on. What do you see? Yeah, do you see the ownership there? Spoken ownership, and I don't mean that in a bad way. I just mean when Paul says to the church at Corinth, look, when you get married, your body's no longer yours, it's your spouse's. He says, I have come into my garden, my balsam, my honeycomb, my myrrh. I've eaten its choice fruits. He claims ownership. Yeah. What else do you notice? Yeah, is he enjoying her, or has he enjoyed her?
Both.
Yeah, both. It looks to be past tense, does it not? It's the idea that they've already now consummated this union. They've enjoyed that oneness together. And in a very sweet way, he is delighted in the intoxication of his wife. They've delighted together. Just a note on that. Trying to figure out a way to say this appropriately. In most premarital contexts, physical intimacy has a pattern to it, and it's take. He wants to get something from you. You're like, well, fine, I'll get something from you, and it's take. In a marital context, God shows us his design. That physical intimacy is not take, it's give. In this moment, she is delighted to provide satisfaction for her husband. And in this moment, he is delighted to provide fulfillment and satisfaction for his wife. It's give. When a relationship shifts to take, even in a marriage, it's a recipe for an affair. Because what you're saying in that moment is, I want to get my needs met. And I go, okay, time out. You've been crucified with Christ. It's no longer you who lives. It's Christ who lives in you. Paul says, I beat my body. I make it my slave. So after I've preached to others, I won't be disqualified for the prize. The key driver in my marriage is not me. The key driver in my marriage is her. And ladies, the key driver in your marriage should be him. Which means there are times in a marriage, guys, where you're going to have a headache. Guys are like, to heck you say, I will never. I promise you, there will come a time when your wife will say, hey, what do you think? And you're going to go, you know what? Nah. I promise you. Call me a liar, but married guys know exactly what I'm talking about. But there are also times where you go, you know what? I'm not in the mood, but I'm here for you. Because the physical needs of a person in a marriage are the responsibility of the spouse. I'm not responsible for meeting my physical needs. My wife is. She's not responsible for meeting her physical needs. I am. You understand what I'm saying? So there's a give. It's not about you. It's about your spouse. And so in this moment, it's an incredible picture of mutual satisfaction. Now, it's hard to affirm this theory. Just, I'll throw that out. But it looks to me as if God speaks one time in the book. And I think it's here. It doesn't make sense that it would be him, the husband, or the Shulamite, her. It doesn't make sense that it would be the daughters of Jerusalem because this is a private moment. It looks to be that this is God speaking. And look at what he says, if that's indeed the case, bottom of verse 1. Eat, friends, drink, and imbibe deeply, O lovers. This feels to me very similar to, forgive me for this connection, but in my mind I go, yeah. Do you remember when Stephen was stoned to death in Acts 7? And the heavens open, and he sees the Son of Man seated at the right hand, almost like standing in ovation, like, yes, I'm applauding you, I celebrate you. As you confess me to your death, I stand in ovation of you. This feels like that to me. Probably because when you recognize the hard, heavy lifting that a couple does in a dating and courtship and engagement process, and then they're married, and now they enjoy the fruits of their labor, of their chastity, of their commitment to Christ, they now enjoy that oneness together, it feels to me as if God in that moment would go, yes, that's what I created it to be. That's what I want you to enjoy. That's what I've been talking about. Like all these things you've learned in junior high and high school, all these things that people talk about as being really the joys of sex in college, that's nonsense. This is what I created for you. Mutual, exclusive satisfaction with a husband and a wife that is so much deeper than physical. There's an emotional connection, a spiritual connection that supersedes the physicality of it. That's what I'm talking about. That's the why. So as you're talking to young adults especially, as you're talking to students of any sort, we've got to get them to the why. Now look, you can't talk about the why a ton because people start freaking out. You know, their temperature gets all weird, you know. So you can't focus on the why a ton, but we can't leave the why out. Does that make sense? We got to prepare them for that journey before marriage, but we've got to show them the promised land. That makes sense? So that's intimacy. Now, a couple thoughts on that, and then we'll transition to conflict. I would say this. One, there's no mention of procreation. So we talked about that a little bit, that intimacy is to be enjoyed. It's interesting that the book forms what's called an inclusio, so it brackets the figurehead moment of the entire book, and that is intimacy. And so it builds to intimacy and builds off of intimacy. Intimacy is sort of the climax of the book, no pun intended. So just important to note that. Three, intimacy, effective intimacy, is an overflow of emotional connection. So the cycles in marriage of give, give, that's where the real beauty of intimacy is found. You don't build a marriage on sex. I don't want to break your heart, but you don't do that. You don't build a marriage on sex. But it's essential for the health of a marriage, to the point where Paul's going to say to the believers at Corinth, who were like, well, then, if immorality is bad, well, then sexual indulgence as a couple must also be bad, so we should stop coming together. And Paul tells them in 1 Corinthians 7, look, stop depriving one another before a short time, and that for the purpose of prayer, but come back together so that Satan would not have a foothold in your marriage. So intimacy is very, very important in a marriage, but not for the reason most singles think. Most singles think it so you can get your needs met. And I don't think that's the pattern. I've got a buddy of mine, I went to elementary school with him, been in a marriage for a long, long time, has not had intimacy with his wife physically in over a decade. And I'm like, oh, dang. And sure enough, marriage is on the rocks. He's in an affair waiting to happen. Can't believe he's lasted 10 years. And it causes a wedge in a union. So you need to come together. You need to be together. You need to have those moments of intimacy together. Now, here's the thing that's going to drive singles crazy. You need to have that intimacy together, but that intimacy doesn't always mean sex. It doesn't always mean sexual things. You're going to find yourself incredibly satisfied with snuggling with your spouse and not having one thing lead to another. You're going to find that mornings of having a cup of coffee with your bride are as intimate and satisfying and fulfilling as any sexual fantasy you could ever try to take captive in your mind as a single. And I didn't understand that until I got married. I'm like, now I fully get it. It's a oneness expression. All right. I would say also it's a process, not an event. So guys, the effectiveness of your intimacy in the bedroom starts in the kitchen when you take the trash out. It starts when you fill her car up with gas because you happen to notice she was low. It starts when you take your sweaty clothes after the gym and put them actually where it belongs, which is probably outside and burned. But you take care of your stuff so that she's not feeling like she's your maid. That's really where it begins. And so it's a process. It's also a process that when you really look at the issue of intimacy, it's something that is enjoyed over time. And so I would say to most men who are newlyweds, I say, look, calm down, slow down, all right? Because what we see, unfortunately, in the media, on movies primarily, not pornographic movies, but just any movie that has some sort of sex scene, it's like, you know, the Twilight, you know, throw here, boom, dresser's over there. She's like, ah, they're ripping their clothes off, breaking through a wall. I'm like, dude, what are you doing? Stop. Like, just, you're talking about the fragileness of a wife. Like, that's not what God intended. And then final one, a healthy sex life will not solve the lust issue. So for those of you guys who are just like hanging on by a thread, hoping that one day, finally, when you're married, woo, all those temptations will go away. It's just going to break your heart. That is not the case. You are going to struggle with lust until the day you die. So just be mindful of that. So create the proper patterns now. If you're creating a pattern that says when I'm feeling things, I indulge, whether it's self-soothing or whatever else, then even as a married, that's the pattern you're going to have. All right? So it will not solve the lust issue. Okay? Any questions on intimacy? Before we transition, people are like, no, please move on. All right, let's move on. And this is one of the reasons I appreciate this book. If you look from a Bible study method standpoint at the laws of proportion, you could make the argument that what an author spends the most time on is the issue that's of most importance. So take one of the Gospels, for example, any of them. The lion's share of the content is the final Passion Week of Christ. It is the most important topic in all of the Gospels, is that final week. I mean, you got 3+ years of the life of Jesus, and you got 80 or 90% of the content about the final 7 days. Why? Because that was the significance, okay? Now, when you come to the Song of Solomon, it is interesting that you have more material on the issue of conflict, 28 verses on conflict, than any other subject. Now, why is it that God would include in a manual of understanding marital love and romance, why would he include more information on conflict than any other subject matter? Would any of the married couples here like to give us your opinion on why conflict would get more content than any other topic in this whole book? It happens all the time. Married couples, married folks who are here, do you agree with that statement? And can you expand on that a little bit?
God knows that we need to know how to resolve conflict.
Yeah. The first question I ask a couple that comes into my office for premarital counseling is, tell me how you fight. And they go, oh, no, we never fight. We're in love. You're hosed. You're totally hosed. Because that's not reality. You're always going to fight. The question is, how do you fight? And can you fight in a way that is honoring to the Lord? People go, well, that seems like that's an oxymoron. How do you fight in a way that's honoring to the Lord? I go, no, that's the point. Like, you're a sinner. I don't know if you knew that or not. But you're a sinner. And you married a sinner. Now, you're very well informed and aware of their sin. But you need to look in the mirror a little bit, too, because you bring that to this marriage. Conflict is where the joy in marriage is found. And you go, well, what? I thought sex is where the joy in marriage is found. I go, no, conflict, and I'll show you why. This relationship now, immediately following sex, goes into conflict. Does that seem humorous to you? See, the illusion is, right, I'm just going to get married, we're just going to have sex, woo, unicorns, puppy dogs, yay, life is always awesome. And immediately following this intimacy, this bridal chamber experience, we get the first conflict. I was asleep, but my heart was awake, verse 2. A voice, my beloved was knocking. Open to me, my sister, my darling, my dove, my perfect one. For my head is drenched with dew and my locks with the damp of the night. So he's calling to her, his dove, his beautiful one. Here he comes, knight in shining armor, coming to enjoy yet again the indulgence with his wife. Knock on the door. Honey! Honey! I don't have my keys. Baby, I'm locked out. Dude, it's cold out here. Help her brother out. How does she respond, verse 3? Will one of you ladies read that in, like, the snottiest voice you can? Come on, go for it.
I had put off my garment. How could I put it on? I had bathed my feet. How could I soil them?
Very nice. Yes, that's exactly right. That's the tone of verse 3. I'm already taking my dress off. I mean, just pouty, whiny. I don't want to put my robe on. I don't want to dirty my feet. Meanwhile, her husband's locked out of the house. Now, I want to give you a principle regarding conflict. Conflict is always a flashpoint. It's a spark. And in that moment, you, in whatever argument it is, whether it's a big spark or a little spark, it really doesn't matter. You carry with you two buckets at all times. One is a bucket of water. One is a bucket of gas. And you have a choice to make every single time conflict arises in your relationship, whether, again, it's a big conflict or a little conflict. And what you're going to find, most of the stuff you're going to squab about is sparks, tiny little who cares stuff that at the end of the day doesn't really matter. But for some reason, it matters to you a lot. All right? And so here we go. We've got now a spark. How is he going to respond in this conflict? And what you're going to find is, I want to create a contrast for you. There is a response and there is a reaction, and they're very different. For example, a reaction is typically driven by pride, typically driven by anger. How could you do that to me? Therefore, and you power up. Okay? Any conflict, you're laughing. You must see that in your marriage. So it's very common. A reaction comes from the flesh. It comes from pride, and it'll be driven by anger. Now, here's a problem with anger. When James, who, by the way, grew up in the home of Jesus, says that you should be slow to speak, quick to listen, slow to become angry. Why? Next verse. Because the anger of man never accomplishes the righteousness of God. I want you to think back to the last time you reacted in anger, okay? You got cut off in traffic, somebody, I don't know, knocked over your coffee, whatever angers you, whatever it is. I want you to think about how you reacted in anger. Replay the tape for a moment and ask yourself the question, was that honoring to the Lord? Like, was the Lord looking down from heaven going, oh yeah, that was fantastic, that pleases me? No, of course not, right? Because it's driven by the flesh, and you say something, hey, beep, beep, hey. And then all of a sudden you're like, oh, that's not the way I'm supposed to act. Like, where'd that come from? But it came out really naturally, didn't it? It just kind of came out. And you're like, oh. In this moment now, reaction would kill this marriage. Why? Because wrath is fierce and anger is a flood, but who can stand before it? James talks about, again, the righteousness of God never really being exalted by the anger of man. The danger in reacting is that once you react, it's hard to pull it back. So you react, you set it. Well, you never, I'm sick and tired of. It's like throwing a grenade, blowing up your spouse, but then afterwards going, oh, that didn't turn out like I wanted, I'm sorry. As if she's going to go, okay, it doesn't matter. Because you've already blown it up, so there's shrapnel there in your marriage, which leaves scar tissue. And so it's very difficult to pull back. You lose perspective. When you react, you start using language like, you always, you never, which isn't true. Do you always, really? Do you never? No, we use that language because it helps sort of polarize extremes. It becomes very accusatory. In reaction, it's them. It's never you, it's them. And as soon as you start pointing fingers, you're failing to recognize what God has called you to be in your marriage. And I think in that, it creates a sense of battle mode. You know, like, I've never found a spouse, as I've been counseling couples now, who she gets angry and yells at him, and he goes, you know what, you're so right. I mean, until you raised your voice, I didn't understand. But as you raised your voice, it all became clear to me. Thank you for helping me understand that you're right and I'm wrong all the time. It just doesn't go down like that. That's not a way to, a healthy way at least, to do a relationship. And so instead of reacting, can we respond? I mean, think for a moment, what is the fruit of the Spirit? It's love and joy, peace and patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. How do we respond in love? How do we respond in a way that honors God? To keep fervent in love for one another, because love covers a multitude of sins. To show preference to one another in honor. To leave vengeance to the Lord. To be devoted to one another in brotherly love. And in that, to honor God. Watch what this guy does. This is fascinating. So he's locked out. And he chooses in verses 4 and following to respond. My beloved extended his hand through the opening, and my feelings were aroused for him. I arose to open to my beloved, and my hand dripped with myrrh, and my fingers with liquid myrrh on the hands of the bolt. What does that mean? Why myrrh? What's the big deal with myrrh? Have we seen? Is this the first time we've seen myrrh? No. She said, my beloved is to me like a pouch of myrrh, which lies all night between my breasts. When she was reflecting upon the relationship, she's like thinking about him at night, like, wow, this guy's fantastic. And he puts myrrh there. Well, what does that mean? Why would he do that? What is he doing? What's he doing?
Being gentle, he's reminding her.
Yeah, why myrrh, though? Anybody? Does that mean anything to you? Other than, wow. I play that to my wife. She knows exactly what I'm saying. Not in an inappropriate way. That's a song we dance to at our wedding. I play that. I take her back and I go, look, this is who I said I was, and this is who I still am. He puts liquid myrrh on the door so that she smells the fragrance and is instantly reminded he has been a good dude for a long time. And that smell brings it back. That memory brings it back. Do you have those kind of things in your marriages, those of you who are married? It may not be a song like that, because I admit that's over the top. It's the most phenomenal song I've ever heard. But you have something like that. Songs, smells, vacation spots, code words, whatever. And what he does is take her back. But notice, she extends her hands through the opening and her feelings were aroused. Can I tell you what's never going to arouse your wife? Is if you yell at her. You raise your voice and it will never, ever, ever cause her to be aroused. It might cause her to be something, but it will not cause her to be aroused. This man doesn't bang on the door. He doesn't yell at her. He doesn't punish her. He doesn't rub her nose in the conflict. He simply leaves the myrrh and responds in love and walks away and lets her sit in it. Lets her think about it. See, here's the thing about reacting, by the way. If I'm in a conflict with my wife and she's in the wrong and she wounds me and I wound her back, where's the focus of God's attention? Is it on her? No, it's on me. Because I reacted instead of responding. Guy years ago came to our church. He was looking to date a girl. I thought he was a solid dude. We had a solid gal in our church. I set them up. First and only time I will ever set anyone up. Now, if you want to get set up, talk to my wife. But don't talk to me. I will not do it again because this guy ruined it for life. Because he defiled this girl. I mean, just defiled her. And I was furious. And I called him into my office. I'm like, what the heck? You did this and this? Well, she did. I'm like, whoa. What about you? He wouldn't own any of it. And I was so angry. So angry. And I go, you know what you are? I go, you're a chicken shit. You ought to be ashamed of yourself. How dare you treat a woman like... And I got in his face like that. And I dropped it. Angry. Finger in his chest. In that moment, I reacted in anger. And where was the focus of God's attention? Because it wasn't on him. The issue was now me. How could you call me that? First letter after that meeting, I just can no longer submit to your leadership because clearly you're a man driven with anger. I'm like, second letter, I'm really struggling in my faith because the man that I thought was my pastor and was a godly man clearly is not because of the use of your language. I'm like, yeah, but you... Third letter, I'm like, are you kidding me? This guy literally crushed me. Now, he was right. But the focus of the conversation, because of my reaction and anger, moved away from him onto me. So this guy responds in love, which, by the way, my apologies for dropping it, but I wanted you to understand the context. I could have said that differently. I don't normally talk like that. Only with this guy, it seems. Anyway, so this guy responds in love, and in that leaves room for her to sit in it and watch what God does. Verse 6 and following. Will one of you ladies read that there, 6 and following, for me?
I opened my beloved, but my beloved had turned and gone. My soul failed me when he spoke. I sought him, but found him not. I called him, but he gave no answer.
Keep going.
The watchmen found me as they went about in the city. They beat me, they bruised me, they took away my veil, those watchmen of the walls. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved, that you tell him,
what does that mean? What happened? What does the text tell us happened, and what do you think that means?
She's hurt by her decision.
Yeah, tell me more about that. She's hurt by her decision. I think you're on to it. What is that? What do you mean, though? Anybody else want to jump onto that? Yeah, have you ever reacted, and then, like, when I just in this room said what I said, and this whole time I'm like, golly, why did I say that? I was dumb. That's the kind of thing I'm talking about. So she's recognizing, I shouldn't have done that. That was dumb. And God is convicting her for her disobedience. And instead of him convicting her, God is convicting her. So all this guy did was, in a loving way, lifted up a mirror and walked away. And let her wrestle with what she saw in the reflection. That's huge. He leaves her to the Lord. Good note or principle. You're never going to change your spouse. I'm just telling you, you're never going to change them. So quit trying to change them. Either embrace who they are or give that to the Lord and let him change them. You can't. Even in conflict. And so this guy just walks away, and she's feeling convicted. So she goes out to find him. What happens while she goes out to find him, and what does that mean?
Looks like she's being punished.
Looks like she gets assaulted, right? I mean, the watchmen find her. They strike her. They wound her. They take away her shawl. Looks like she's assaulted here. What does that mean? It's poetry. Does that mean she literally got beat up? Probably not. But what does it mean? Leave room for the wrath of God, for vengeance is mine, I will repay, declares the husband. No, declares the Lord. So God disciplines her. In her disobedience, God shows her, convicts her, calls her to respond differently. Now, verse 9, this is fascinating. So this is now a conflict that has exploded. He's distanced himself from her, but he's not running away. Look at verse 9. The daughters of Jerusalem ask, what kind of beloved is your beloved? O most beautiful among women, what kind of beloved is your beloved that you adjure us? Tell us who this man is. Like, in the midst of conflict, who is this guy? Yeah, question.
Okay, you're saying punish her disobedience. What exactly is her disobedience in this situation? It's not the fact that she didn't want to have sex with him, it's the way that she reacted in that.
Yeah, it's not the sex.
I'm just trying to make
sure. No, absolutely, it's not the sex. It's that literally this guy is trying to like come into his own house. And her response is, oh gosh, I don't blah 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 blah. He's like, oh, okay. And he walks away. It's not that he's wanting to have sex with her per se, so this isn't a bedroom issue. This is more of like the stupid things couples fight about issue. Just out of curiosity, for any of you, how many of you again who are married? How many of you here are married? Okay. Can you give me just a couple, without selling your spouse out, just a couple of the little things that you've found conflict in? Stack the dishwasher. One of the number one in my home, because I think engineers designed it for a reason, so things could go in certain places. To my wife. Okay. Yeah. Absolutely. What else? Stuff like that. Come on, help us out. What are the little things?
Folding clothes.
Folding clothes. Yes. What's that? You guys are too scared, huh? Like, I'm not, no way am I saying nothing. It's little things. The point is, these conflicts are little things. It could be this or 100 other stupid things as to why did you lose your keys again? Or why is there paint on our kitchen table? You have a studio. Don't use a kitchen table. Or, hey, sweetie, I've told you like 1,000 times, when you park in the driveway, when you park like that, I can't pull in. So could you just pull in the way I've asked you to park 1,000 times? Or, hey, babe, do we have an extra house key? Yeah. 7? Yeah. Stashed all over our front yard? Why do we have 7 keys in our front yard? That doesn't make sense to me. These are true stories. I took a picture of our toothpaste about 3 months ago and posted it. She's a squeezer, I'm a folder. That bothers me. It shouldn't, but it does, okay? She wants to talk at night while we're in bed. I want to climb in bed to go to sleep. But this morning when I woke up at 4:30, she's not getting up at 4:30, okay? Just different. Now we can fight about that stuff. Just like they could fight about this. Does that make sense? So don't read into this one moment. Read into this a flashpoint spark that's an example of 1,000 different stupid things. Okay? So principle-wise, though, he's going to respond in love, separates himself, lets her sit in it. God disciplines her. And then again in verse 9 now, they ask, what is your beloved like? And in the midst of conflict, somebody read verses 10 and following. Listen to how she speaks of her man in the midst of conflict. One of you ladies read that there.
Sorry, where did you say 5:10?
10 and following.
Okay. My beloved is radiant and ruddy, distinguished among 10,000. His head is the finest gold, his locks are wavy, his lashes are raven. His eyes are like doves, his lips are bathed in milk, sitting beside him like a wolf. His cheeks are like beds of spices, mounds of sweet smelling herbs.
Okay, you get the point. Look at verse 14. Hands are rods of gold, set with beryl, abdomen, verse 15, legs, his appearance, his 16, mouth, full of sweetness, as he is wholly desirable. This is my beloved, and this is my friend. What does she say about her man in the middle of an unresolved conflict? How does she speak of him? He's the best. Is he always the best? Heck no. In her nakedness, is there no blemish in her? Heck no. But together, they look beyond the limitations. They look beyond those little things to go, no, no. At the end of the day, she's saying, my guy's pretty awesome. He's dazzling. He's fantastic. He's my friend. My best friend is my wife. She's been my best friend for 17 plus years. She knows everything. Not a single thing in my life that's hidden from her. She knows it all. And there's some good things that she knows. There's also some bad things that she knows. There's some things I'm real proud of. There's some things I'm a little embarrassed by. She knows it all. She's my friend. That's what a marriage is. And in the midst of unresolved conflict, do you see the sweetness of how she speaks to him? This mouth is incredibly, as James talks about, incredibly deadly. In a moment of unfiltered bleh, we can say something that can wound our spouse. And this woman, in the midst of unresolved conflict, is speaking so kindly of him. And the question that's asked in verse 1 from the daughters of Jerusalem, where is your beloved gone, O most beautiful among women? Where is your beloved turned that we may seek him with you? She is asked the question of where is your beloved? Now what's fun is in verse 2, does she know where he's at? No? Are you sure? Look at verse 2. Where is he? Yeah, she knows exactly where he's at. What's the point? In an immature conflict, it would be easy, first of all, for the guy to react in anger. Secondly, it would also be easy for him to respond in love and then disappear, peel out down the street, not sure where he's at. She's calling friends. Hey, have you seen him? I don't know where he's at. You know, I can't find him. He's down at the bar, throwing down a pint at Grog's or whatever, right? It'd be easy for that to happen. In the midst of conflict, she knows exactly where he is. She knows exactly where to find him because she trusts him, and he's reacting in a way, or responding rather, in a way that's very predictable. Look at what she says in verse 3. She knows where he is, and she says, I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine. It's actually what's on my ring in Hebrew. Me for my beloved, and my beloved for me. There's a sense of mutual satisfaction in this relationship. She knows where he's at, and now she's going to go find him. And she's going to seek reconciliation quickly. Because for every moment that goes by with unresolved conflict, a wedge deepens in your marriage. Watch verse 4 and following. You are as beautiful as Tirzah, my darling, as lovely as Jerusalem, as awesome as an army with banners. Turn your eyes away from me, for they have confused me. For your hair is like a flock of goats. Your teeth, verse 6, are like a flock of ewes. Verse 7, your temples. Verse 8, let me deal with verse 8 in a minute. So, do you see what's happening? Does that sound familiar, by the way? The bottom of verse 5 and 6 and 7. It's almost repeated from what we heard on the honeymoon night. She's coming to reconcile with him, and he sees her coming. And she has that look on her face. Not that sexual look on her face, that look on her face that says, my bad, sorry. My wife can communicate to me in ways without words. I know exactly what she's saying, just based on the look on her face, just based on her countenance. And there are moments where she'll approach after conflict, and usually, by the way, it's me who has to approach her because I've done something dumb and she's let me sit in it. But every once in a while, she'll approach me and I could just tell by the look on her face what she's saying. My bad, I'm sorry, shouldn't have done that. And there's a longing to restore the oneness of our relationship, not merely sexual, I'm talking about emotional and spiritual restoration. And that's what this guy sees by her approaching. And so he quotes, in a sense, the honeymoon night. Why would he quote the honeymoon night? Same reason I play that stupid song. It takes us back to when love and our union felt like it was at its purest. Like that's when everything was like awesome because we had not fought yet because we were newlyweds. So, you know, life is great. And so it's taking you back to that moment. And so in the process of that, he's just reminded of the beauty of their love. Now, the reason I stop at verse 8, if I had a least favorite verse in this entire book, it's verse 8. Because again, right now, it's like, oh, isn't this great? This is awesome. And then in verse 8, you're reminded. It's like, oh. It says, there are 60 queens and 80 concubines and maidens without number, but my dove, my perfect one, is unique. It seems like either he's referring in pattern to her being the mare among the chariots of Pharaoh, the rose of Sharon, the lily of the valleys, And here, even amongst concubines and queens, she is distinct. That's what I want to believe, but I can't help but wonder, based on what we know about Solomon's life, if this is just a snapshot into the to the behind the scenes of what was happening in his life in terms of his immorality. I don't know. I'd like to think it's a pattern, but when you teach the book and you get to verse 8, it's like, ah! Like, this is a terrible example. Do you remember the Marcus Wesson case? The guy who killed like 9 kids here in Fresno? The first responding officer that was on the scene comes to our church, so we've actually talked about that. But we were talking a week or two after that all went down about Grace, and so I had a picture of him, not the cop, Marcus Wesson, that I wanted to show during my message to say, man, can we show Grace to a guy like that? You know, like, what does that look like? Because we tend to reserve grace for people who, quote unquote, deserve it. And in the middle of worship, our tech guy messed up and hit the wrong slide. So we're singing worship, you know. I don't know what song we're singing. And then all of a sudden, his image came on the screen. And literally, the congregation went, ah! Like, people physically responded because, like, ah! It just was so out of context. That's what verse 8 and 9 feels to me. Ah! Just out of context. Like, dang it. Why is that in there? So I don't know which it's referring to. But either way, don't miss what's happening now in this restored relationship. So in conflict, she's pursuing him. She's seeking restoration. Notice now, verse 10, who is this that grows like the dawn, as beautiful as a full moon, as pure as the sun, and awesome as an army with banners? And then she speaks. I went down to the orchard of nut trees to see the blossoms of the valley, to see whether the vine had budded or the pomegranates had bloomed. Before I was aware, my soul set me over the chariots of my noble people. Verse 11, what's she doing? What does that mean? Do you remember the courtship process? What time of year was the courtship process? Spring. Vines have budded. Flowers have given their fragrance. What's she doing in verse 11? She's asking a very interesting question that my wife and I ask all the time. Hey, baby, are we okay? Are we still good? Are we going to make it through this? And in that process now, before she was aware, her soul was set over the chariots of her noble people. What does he do? Verse 12. Translate that for me. Yeah, he's like, get over here. Get on my back. Piggyback ride. Chicken fight in the pool. Get over here. Gives her a noogie lovingly. It's that kind of like playful. Come on, we're fine. My wife and I asked that question. Hey, are we okay? I'm like, baby, we're good. Let's slow dance. You know, we'd mess around and laugh, start swing dancing in the kitchen. It's playful. It's restorative. It's just a recognition that, look, this conflict, we're going to make it through any of these, big or small, regardless of how big the spark is. I got a bucket of water, baby. I'm going to pour that water on that spark. I will not blow it up. I will not escalate. And if a marriage can operate like that, then you can experience now this sense of restoration. In verse 13, he snatches her away. They're calling for her to come back. And there's a recognition now of a restored oneness in the relationship. Part of the reason, by the way, it's important to solve a conflict, meaning to finish it, is if you don't, then at some point there's another spark and it's like nuclear bomb and you're trying to figure out that wasn't that big a deal. Why did it blow up that big? And you realize if you don't deal with unresolved conflict, then in a new conflict, you're not just hysterical, you're historical. So it's really not just that conflict, but you're adding up all the other things that you haven't solved. Unresolved conflict is like putting a body in a closet. Like, at some point, you think it's out of sight, out of mind. We've moved on from it, right? But if you haven't really dealt with it, at some point, it's going to start to reek. And it's all going to come out, body after body that you're hiding in there, are all going to come out. So a good marriage is not a marriage without conflict. A good marriage is a marriage with conflict, resolved with health. Because that's what reaffirms the oneness. My wife and I have been through the valley, man. We have fought over stuff. I am not easy to get along with. And we have fought, and our personalities could not be more different. I mean, if you know my wife, you'll go, how in the world does that work? How does she not choke you? And how, I just don't get it. And yet it's awesome because we are so different. But because we've resolved conflict over almost 20 years, there's a deepening that happens in our marriage. It doesn't mean there's not insecurity. There's constantly that sense of, are we still okay? Are we still okay? Are we still okay? It's like, yeah, we're good, baby, we're good. And we're going to keep resolving that conflict because I want to suggest to you the real joy in a marriage is the resolution of conflict. Because it reminds us, me for my beloved for me. And regardless of the conflict, we're going to be okay. And if that can be your mentality, to where you're going to pursue oneness at all costs, you're going to resolve conflict at all costs, you're going to say the hardest words in a marriage that you can ever say, which is, you know what? I'm sorry. That's on me. That's on me and me alone. Interesting, by the way, keep in mind when you're conflicted, just keep track of this. Oftentimes we apologize, but veiled underneath that apology is an insult. I'm sorry, baby. It's just when you do that, it really makes me angry. So I'm sorry. Oh, wait a minute. Are you sorry or are you accusing? Like, which is it? And we do that in marriage all the time. When couples come into my office who are having conflict, it is fascinating because it's like that. Nobody wants to look at their issue. It's always the other. Well, I'm like, okay, well, what part of that do you need to own? Me. It's about them. I'm like, okay, wait a second. If you're going to ever resolve conflict, you've got to begin to look at what your portion is. Good rule of thumb in conflict, by the way, check yourself. Okay? Check yourself. That's where it starts because you've got a portion to play in it, no question. It's never always the other person's fault. So check yourself. Keep the circle small. So if you need to get some advice on it, get some advice, but don't post it on Facebook, okay? Go to the source, okay? So make sure that if you have a conflict with your spouse, you're talking to your spouse about it, not everybody else about it, okay? And then ultimately, you want to close the loop. You want to make sure that conflict is resolved and that you've agreed that it's resolved and can move forward. If you'll do that, you'll experience chapter 7. Now, just let me set up chapter 7. Do any of you remember Pastor Johnson? He was at People's Church for like 150 years. So Pastor Johnson is now with Jesus, and he is a hero of mine. He never knew this, but he was a hero, primarily because of an interaction we had in a moment. I was at a graduation party. I was a new believer, and Pastor Johnson is, I mean, everybody called him Pastor Johnson, but behind his back called him PJ. And so Pastor Johnson, PJ, was like this epic suit and tie, kind, godly, tender, gentle saint. And I'm at the buffet line, boom, face to face with Pastor Johnson. Now that's like face to face with Peyton Manning or whoever you would say, oh, wow. So that person. And so now I'm trying to talk to Pastor Johnson and I can't figure out what to say. I mean, you're so great. I like wanted an autograph. It was that kind of like starstruck moment. And I'm like, golly, you're a doofus. And so anyway, I'm trying to share with him, hey, thanks for being faithful in ministry. Thank you for who you are. Grateful to be in our city together in ministry, whatever, right? But I couldn't say anything articulate. And he finally rescues me. And he goes, Brad, I'd like you to meet my bride, Jackie. Bride. That dude was married for like 50 years plus. Bride? Jackie? And I thought, oh yeah, that is awesome. And I want one day to introduce my sweet gray-haired bride to some other doofus like me. Because what he did in that moment is so affirmed his wife. And I thought, I want that. And so you probably have heard me refer to my wife as my bride. You can blame Pastor Johnson for that, because that moment shaped me as a hero, even in that moment, because he understood chapter 7. He understood that a marriage could indeed deepen. Watch what happens. It says, how beautiful are your feet in sandals, O prince's daughters. The curves of your hips are like jewels, the work of your hands like an artist. Your navel is like a round goblet, never lacking mixed wine. Your belly is like a heap of wheat, fenced about with lilies. Your breasts are two fawns, your neck, your eyes, your nose, your head. Down to verse 6, how beautiful and how delightful you are, my love, with all your charms. Now, It's similar to chapter 4, is it not? The honeymoon night? And yet it's different. What's different? What's the first thing he notices in chapter 7? I didn't think my wife even had feet for the first several years of my marriage. I just didn't care about her feet. Like, why would you? It's a foot. But now I've had to rub those feet so much. Those feet have been in my lap so many times, me rubbing her feet. She's got this thing, she can move her little toe all by itself. I can't even move my little finger by itself. She can move her little toe. Her feet are tiny, size 7, and they're slim. I mean, literally, tiny feet. And I know about my wife's feet now. And I'm very thankful for those little feet. All right? Not only feet, though, what else does he notice in the early verses of chapter 7?
Thighs.
If you're a newlywed, fellas, do not comment on her thighs. Leave it alone. Don't go there. It's not worth it. What else does he go to there that's not worth it for a newlywed, but in chapter 7, you can? What else does he see? Her belly. What else? What else? Feet, belly. Yeah, navel. Hips. No, not a chance this side of heaven should any of you who are newlyweds ever comment on those things about your wife. But you know what happens as love deepens? You see things you didn't see before. You appreciate things you didn't appreciate before. You're drawn to things you weren't drawn to before. And that's what's happening here. That's how love deepens. There's an appreciation, a maturation, nuances and new things and exciting things that you get to enjoy and experience together. But I want to push on the idea or notion that as a marriage gets older, it's just you slurping soup. It's not like that. Because it's not just feet, hips, navel, belly. Verse 3, it's still her breasts. Verse 4, her neck and her eyes. As it gets down to verse 6, she is beautiful and delightful with all of her charms. It's not just her physical, it's who she is as a person. All of her. And her stature, verse 7, is like a palm tree, and her breasts are like clusters. And so he says, I will climb the palm tree and take hold of its fruit stalks. Oh, that your breasts may be like clusters of the vine, and the fragrance of your breath like apples. Is it still exciting? Yes. But what is it that's making it exciting? Her feet. Her hips. You know the thing I'm fascinated with right now regarding my wife? Her giggle. She has this little giggle. She'll say something and then go, ha, and kind of move on. And I'm thinking, you can get away with anything if you'll just drop that giggle on the back end. I mean, we're in life group last night, and she said something. I was like, oh, dang, I can't believe she said that. And then she did the giggle, and everybody just kind of went, oh, okay. I'm like, how does she do that? It's like a gift. It's like the Jedi mind trick, you know? Hey, you're a big doofus. And everybody goes, yeah, I am. You know, I don't know how she does it. But of late, I'm fascinated by that. I wouldn't have thought about that in the early days. There's just new things I'm finding out about her. There's a painting up in my office. We'd been married 10 years. And I had ugly furniture and ugly walls and was trying to find a painting to match it all. We couldn't find anything. I came home one day, there was a painting on the mantle. I go, babe, where'd you find that? She says, I painted that. I was like, what? I didn't know you could paint 10 years into our marriage. Never painted anything. And I was like, that's new. And so there's all this newness, all this excitement, if you'll allow love to deepen. Now look, we mentioned looks don't last. I don't look the same as I did when I got married. And chances are it's not going to get any better. Okay? But the good news is if you allow love to deepen, it's really not about what's on the outside. It's about the little things. It's about the things that you begin to notice that you never would have noticed before. And notice it still gets exciting in verses 7 and 8. Verse 9, the wife is going to speak. And actually, what you see in verses 8 and 9, I think the chapter or the verse division may be off, because if you read verse 8, he says, I will climb my palm tree, I will take hold of its fruit stalks. And she says, oh, may your breasts be like clusters of the vine, and the fragrance of your breath like apples, and your mouth like best wine. Do you see how it looks like it could continue on? I think it does with him, and then I think she now interrupts and says, and it goes down smoothly for my beloved, flowing through the lips of those who fall asleep. I think there's a shift there. So he's speaking, and then she says, oh yeah, this wine goes down smoothly and causes you to just go ahead and snore. And I think it's a play on words. I think it's meant to be sort of funny. You know, the big joke in sitcoms or whatever is that a married couple, when they're physically intimate, immediately after he's snoring. I think that's kind of what she's referring to here. But I think it's also the recognition of what you see. My wife and I have... I'm not going to share that one. that was a filter. It was a last-minute filter. It almost didn't make it. We've been known to watch each other sleep. Not in a stalker way, but just like I'm just looking at my sweet wife, you know? She's out. And there's this sense of like, that's my girl right there. You know, it just like warms my heart as I see her there. And I want you to notice that as this marriage deepens, I think verse 10 is a key. And I want to challenge you men to really understand what verse 10 means, okay? One of you men read that. Actually, check that. One of you ladies read that.
I am my beloved's.
And his desire is for what? Me. Now, here's what I want you men to think about. I am my beloved's. So she knows she is his. And what she's also saying in verse 10 is his desire. Do any of your Bibles translate that different than desire? His passion. His consuming focus. His obsession. The best of his time. The best of his money. The best of his energy. The best of his leadership. The best of his creativity. The best of who he is as a man is given to me. That is big. Guys, what happens is a young man gets married, and he starts focusing on all the things that the world says to focus on to the neglect of the most important thing God says to focus on. It really doesn't matter, by the way, if you're a scratch golfer. Who gives a rip if your wife is unhappy? It really doesn't matter if you make a boatload of money if your wife feels like an afterthought. It really doesn't matter if you have a boat and a Harley, okay, and a third car garage and a big house with a pool, if you have an unhappy wife. How dare you invest your life, the best of who you are, in anything but her? She knows. I'm my beloved's, and his greatest passion is me. You want to give your spouse security over time? Let her know that she's more important than anything else. It's absolutely crucial. One of the ways I try to do that is I try to never send my wife to voicemail if I can. So she calls in a meeting. I'll typically, if I can, take the call. Hey, baby, I'm in a meeting. Oh, you are? Every Tuesday at this time, I'm in a meeting every single week. Okay, I'll call you back. You know, which, by the way, that's a perfect picture of what happens in my marriage. Like all the time. Hey, babe, I just blah, 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 blah. And then she's talking to someone else. I'm like, hello, you know, I'm on the phone, she's talking to someone else, I'm like, but I try to not send her a voicemail. I try to value my day off if I can, as much as I can, and if I can't, I try to make up for it. So, okay, I'm going to work, I have a retreat Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, so Monday morning, take the kids to school, I'm going to get some mama time, we're going to hang out, okay? And when I say hang out, I mean I'm going to sit with her and talk with her and invest in her. She knows she's more important to me than anything else. She also knows she's more important to me than our kids. Now, I want to let that sink in a moment. A child is a wonderful addition to a healthy marriage. Do not have a child-centered home, because that kid will come and that kid will go, and she will be there after they're gone. And if you don't invest in that marriage, you're going to be living with a stranger. And what happens oftentimes is mama gets all involved with the kids, so he gets all involved with his career, which is fine until they leave, and now you're trying to figure out who's on first again. And so the challenge, fellas, is to make sure that she knows that your desire is for her. Finally, the book finishes. Come, my beloved, let us go into the country. Let us spend the night in the village. Let us rise early and go to the vineyards. And let us see whether the vine has budded and its blossoms have opened, and whether the pomegranates have bloomed. And there I will give you my love. Who's speaking in 11 and 12? Him or her?
Her.
I think it's really important as you talk about love maturing that you're not afraid to initiate some getaways. Here's what my wife has realized, at least for me. I'm a completely different guy from a stress load level when I'm out of town. Just completely different. Because it's difficult for me, and it's both a blessing and a curse. But it's very difficult for me to go anywhere in Fresno and not see somebody who's like, oh, you're that guy from the well. You know, part of it is the size of our church, but part of it is I've been in Fresno for a long time, been doing ministry now for 14 years as a senior pastor, just a long time. Done a lot of weddings, done a lot of funerals. Oh, you're that guy from the well. Now, thankfully, I don't feel like I live duplicit life. I'm not like one guy in public and then at home I'm a different guy. Like I'm fairly consistent. But when I get out of town, two things happen. One is I don't run into anybody. So there's no pressure. Because what happens inevitably is people are like, you're that guy from the well. Hey, I've been meaning to ask you a question about something. You know, and I'm like, oh man. So I'm having to constantly deal with those things. It's not always like that, but it happens quite often. The second thing that happens is we get time in the car, which is gold. Jen and I in the car is great because I can't run away. And she can focus. It's beautiful. Because my tendency is to be like, look, I got stuff I got to do. I can't handle this. And I'm out. And she'll be distracted by squirrels. And so in the car, it focuses us, right? And it's beautiful. So those things happen. She initiates time away. I would really encourage you ladies to do that. Set time away. You initiate it. Book it. Get out of town. Go for a walk. Hold hands. Book it and put it on his calendar or email his assistant and say, get this on his calendar. We're out, all right? Set up those times. And notice at the bottom of verse 12, she says, there I will give you my love. Verse 13, the mandrakes have given forth their fragrance, and over the doors are all kinds of choice fruits. Again, the garden imagery here. She says, both new and old. When she's talking about their enjoyment together. This is a marriage that is now, you get the impression this is a marriage that is deepening, where they're seeing things they hadn't seen, and it's going to a level it hadn't gone before. And so it is choice fruits, it is fragrant, it is delightful, it is refreshing, it is nurturing, and it is both old and new, which means don't get stuck in a rut. Change things up. Try things different. Try things new. And I'm not talking physically. I'm saying emotionally, spiritually. If you always, in your routine, we go to Pismo and stay at this place and go eat at this place and eat this thing and then go do this, blow it up. Do something completely. Go skydiving. Go snorkeling. Do something different. That's what makes a marriage exciting. Don't get in a rut. If you always go to Yosemite Ranch and get the goat cheese appetizer, go somewhere else. Change it. Make it different. Notice what she says, though. Both new and old, which I have saved up for you, my beloved. It's an exclusive pursuit of continual refreshment and oneness in this marriage. That's how you deepen a marriage. So when you look at this thing over time, it's getting more and more and more and more exciting, as it should, as you become more aware of the complexities of your spouse, the nuances of who they are. It can get more exciting over time. Chapter 8 is part of that inclusio. It's a reflection now of her looking back, saying, boy, I wish, that you were like a brother to me who nursed in my mother's breast, meaning I wish you were like family, because then we could hold hands in public and that'd be cool.
you could hug me in public and it'd be cool, but because you're not family, it's not cool. And so the whole sort of rest of the book is sort of that reflection time. But I think the bulk of the content finishes in that concept there in verse 13 of both old and new. Okay, questions or thoughts on Song of Solomon before we wrap this one up? Yes, sir.
There are a couple of times where she, like in 5:8, mm-hmm. she says, "I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, it's time I've delivered Solomon's sick."
Yeah.
Or over in 5:16, she doesn't say those exact words, but she does mention, like, "O daughters of Jerusalem."
Mm-hmm.
But then I remember you saying that in chapter 2, yeah, in chapter 2 and chapter 3, that it was him saying.
It's him who says, don't arouse or awaken love until it pleases. So it's him who speaks to stop the physical intimacy before the appropriate time.
Okay. So it seemed like it would be her saying that because of the context clues, like contextually.
You're reading a very difficult book on poetry. As I mentioned when we started, that's one of the hardest things is figuring out who's saying what. I'm taking the issue in 2:7 and 3:5 of him shutting down physical intimacy because I think that speaks to the issue of male headship, the responsibility that men have in a relationship to steward that woman. So I'm speaking into that a little bit with that. It's very difficult figuring out who's saying what. That's my take on it. And I say my take. I'm not a scholar by any means. But if you look at Glickman, if you look at Nelson, and you look at Ross, three scholars who do really good work on this, and they don't allegorize the text, all three of those cats lean towards the man speaking as well. So those are the three best scholars I've found on it if you're looking for good commentaries on it. Yeah. Questions or other questions or thoughts? Yes, sir.
Technology to help you get to know someone, that'd be great. The principle I would encourage you to keep in mind is godliness at a point in time is nothing. Godliness over a period of time is everything. The negative to online stuff is you're not really sure what you're getting, and so just make sure that you guard your heart and get to know that person for who they really are, not just who they show you digitally, because everybody's Insta makes them look awesome. So I actually was encouraged last night. I don't do Instagram very often, but I saw an Insta of one of Shakira or whatever artist for her birthday took a selfie with no makeup on, and I thought, thank you. It's interesting, we had it contrasted though with makeup versus no makeup. I'm like, wow, that's different. But I just appreciated that sense of, this is the real me. I was like, wow, thanks, because most people online aren't the real them. They're the them they want to be, and so online you have to be careful with that. I just met a couple, in fact, this last weekend at our network retreat. They're both in their late 60s. They met on eHarmony. Both spouses died. They found each other online, and they've been married now for 7 or 8 years. It's been fun. Yeah. Any other questions or thoughts before we wrap it up? Saturday night, if you're interested, a life group wanted to host an event. So we're going to be doing a couples event here Saturday night. My wife and I are actually going to do an open Q&A, which... my wife and a Q&A can get crazy. So if you're interested, come and join us. You don't have to be in a relationship to come. It will feel like a couples event. So know what you're getting into. But truthfully, I would love for the folks in our church who are looking at relationships to feel like you can come as well.
Where is it at?
Here.
What time?
I think it starts at 6:30, 7? 7. 7? Yeah, 7.
Yeah. So anyway, we're going to be doing that, which, especially if you've never met my wife, it might be worth coming. You just never know. We did an event one time together for Valentine's Day several years ago, and she's not a big fan of speaking in front of people, even though she's incredibly funny. And she, literally, this is like businessmen and women in our community, suit and tie, formal event, really nice. She goes, boy, I'm just so nervous right now, but I'm actually imagining all of you naked right now, or excuse me, in your underwear right now, and it really helps. How'd you do that? Because I'm thinking, I say that, people think I'm creepy. She says that, giggles, everybody goes, I love her. So anyway, that's Saturday night. Let me pray for us. Father in heaven, help us to manage these relationships well, that ultimately we might honor you, that we might learn how to control our vessels in sanctification and honor, learn how to lead from the heart, learn how to be vulnerable and honest, seeking reconciliation and deepening relationships, that God, you might be pleased as we reflect your image in the world around. So God, there's so much in this book. I pray that it would be helpful. Pray, God, that it would challenge us to look differently at these relationships that we have maybe even treated flippantly in previous contexts, but that, God, we might hit the reset button and focus afresh on you and what you would want. So we'll thank you for this day and for this time together. In Christ's name, amen.